It is Saturday, May 10th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org.
Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Mira Software Services, 1,500 software professionals specializing in the areas of software-defined networking, evolved packet core, and more. Details at mera.biz or 650-479-5350.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the Geek's affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the studio with me is Ben Jaffe, a standard geek on the show. You all know and love a web development instructor, musician, and world traveler. Hey, Ben.
How's it going?
Quite well, thank you. I've got a new tree in my yard, thanks to you. So thank you so much. Actually,
last night was really fun. We dug up a 3-in-1 tree out of my backyard,
yep.
Put it in your car, and you planted it in your backyard.
Miles later and lots of windburn later. Actually, it went really well. We buried it this morning. I think it's going to be fine. Though, it's actually 3 trees, and we'll get into that another time. You and I have to talk.
Some other day.
Also, trampoline jumping last night.
Oh, yeah.
You taught me that after you jump on a trampoline for a good 15 minutes, your legs are sore. Then you get off the trampoline. Make sure to do that carefully because the ground's not the same.
And then you jump on the ground, and it's the most
you feel so
horrible,
feeble.
Awkward feeling ever.
It's great. So I urge you to go find a trampoline. Ben's address is... No, we won't do that. Also in the air with me and with us is special guest Shard Mangalik, and he is the product manager at Adobe. He's a photographer, and he's a geek. Hi. Welcome back to the program.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, pleasure. You were last on the program, if people are interested, in, I believe... August of 2013, and we talked about Lightroom and things of that nature. And we're going to talk a little bit more about Lightroom Mobile, which is a kind of a cool thing, and about photo management and stuff in about 20 minutes or so. But first, we'll talk about news. So thanks, Shard, for being here.
Great. Thanks.
All right. Mr. Ben.
Happy World Password Day.
Is it really today, World Password Day?
No. It was today when the article was written 3 days ago. So... May 7th, World Password Day. If you missed it, don't feel bad. Just pretend it's today. And
what's the suggestion on World Password Day? What are you supposed to do?
Just be aware of your passwords.
It's all day. And like sitting on the couch
them.
With a tea.
Yeah.
Just like,
I'm being aware of my passwords today. Like how many people have a password of password 123? That's
my
a lot. Yeah. Oh, well, mine's password 1234. So
ooh.
I'm safe, right?
Yeah.
No, I'm not safe. If your password is your dog's name or your cat's name or your favorite restaurant's name or something like that, even if there's a number afterwards, you know who you are. That's not a good enough password.
Except my dog's name actually has 74 random characters. It's impossible to pronounce.
You know, leave it to you. Leave it to you.
What's your dog's name? I can't tell you.
I can't pronounce it. But you could have the computer pronounce it.
So World Password Day, you're supposed to kind of bring up awareness so that people potentially do better password management?
Yes. We did a whole password show maybe
a year ago.
We've done several. And passwords are just a really awful way of securing anything, right?
I mean,
two-factor authentication. If you are using Gmail or any other service that supports two-factor authentication or validation, use that. Set it up and everything.
But be careful because it's dangerous.
Yeah.
In the sense that you've got to make sure you know what you're doing and you have to have backup.
Basically, you just want to be generally aware of this space instead of ignore it as much as possible. And so you can go to passwordday.org.
Cool.
And it's not just in English. It's in all the different languages. Of course, if you're listening to this program, you probably speak English just fine. And they've actually got a password practice a little game.
What's the site again? Password?
It's passwordday.org.
Cool.
And we'll also put a link up on geekspeak.org.
Absolutely.
And you can play the game while I cover this next quick story, is the Pavlovian password policy and also a Stanford password policy that both very recently came out. So the Stanford password policy, basically it says, if you insist on having a password that's 6 characters long, which is a really short password, then you need to put some special character symbol or weird, have to have a number and a capital letter and all that stuff, right? If your password is like, I don't know how long your password is, 30 or something characters long, your master password, you don't need to put a symbol into that because it's really super secure, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. So the idea is, one of the ideas behind that is, if you make it annoying for users to have short passwords, they'll have longer passwords, right?
That's a good idea.
So I love that idea. So so that's one. And then there's the Pavlovian password management.
Now, what's this? You ring a bell and whatever password you think of, you use?
Now, it's been a long time since I did Psych 1, so I'm not actually sure if Pavlovian password management is the best title for this. But basically, it's about humans and conditioning, right? So in order for us to change a habit, if you want to change a habit, you don't just listen to geek speak and the geeks say, oh, make sure you have strong passwords, and then poof, now you have strong passwords, right? This needs to be reinforced.
Sure.
So the idea is, you choose a password. Let's say you choose a really bad password. Like you choose the password, we'll just say 6 characters and a random number or something. How long will it be before that could be brute forced and cracked? Well, let's say 4 days. That means in 4 days, you have to change your password. And that sucks. Users don't want to do that, right?
I see. So if your password's is bad enough, the system would prompt you every few days to improve into get another one.
Correct. If you have a long password, which will take 2 years to crack brute force, it'll be 2 years before it prompts you.
Yeah,
so that's
cool.
A kind of a neat idea. I love the idea. It rewards or penalizes people based on what passwords they pick and the complexity.
I like it.
So these are two ways of, instead of just saying like, hey, you really need to do this, it's really, really important, which is what we've been saying for years and years and years, instead it gives them incentives and disincentives.
And our current recommendation on the program, or at least mine current recommendation, is to get a password management system like 1Password or LastPass.
Yes,
and
they're both
actually
great.
Use the random generator for passwords, store a database that you manage, and then you have to have access to that database or you don't have access to your passwords. But at least you don't have to memorize passwords anymore.
Also, extremely
really
important, if you don't know this already, don't use the same password for multiple services.
Right.
Especially not between, your bank should be like a super, super secure different one, and your email, because your email can be used to get into other services by sending password resets.
I feel like we could crawl down the password hole in the show and talk about it for the rest of the time.
That's all I have to say about
it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Moving on.
All right, Chard, you've got a story for us.
I do. Yeah. So I travel a ton. And
you travel a lot for work?
For work, for fun. Just love traveling, taking photos on the road. And one of the things that caught my eye was a story that British Airways is actually going to buy something like $500 million of fuel that was created from trash.
Oh, cool.
So there's a company in London that's actually paid by the city of London to pick up this trash. You know, they're like a garbage company. And they've got this crazy chemical process that turns the trash into high-quality fuel that British Airways is going to use to power flights from London to New York.
How do you make high quality fuel out of garbage?
It's
amazing.
No idea, but it's really exciting because, you know, one, it's, you know, it seems like it would be really efficient and it's good for the environment and makes me feel worse about traveling, even though I love traveling.
Right.
But the other thing that I like about it is, you know, one of my favorite movies growing up was Back to the Future.
Oh, yeah,
at
yeah.
the end, they've got the Mr. Fusion, and you pour
Absolutely.
The beer into the...
banana peel.
Yeah.
I love that he pours the beer in, and then he drops the can in.
Exactly. And it's like, you know, this is one step closer to that. Right. So we don't have hoverboards, but we've got the fuel, so...
I love this story because... We cover often like, oh, now there's some process which lets you turn trash into fuel, or this into fuel, or that
right.
into fuel. We cover that all the time. There's scientific breakthroughs all the time. And the biggest problem, at least in my view of this, is adoption.
Productizing
getting people
it.
To actually use it, right? Because who wants to take a risk with a new technology? So that's what makes this story even more awesome and impressive than some of the scientific breakthrough stories, because it's something is happening.
Yeah,
you know.
So when you see when diesel cars move to vegetable oil, the exhaust actually smells like vegetables, kind of. Like, have you ever smelled a car that was on vegetable oil? It definitely smells like your kitchen. You're like, wait a second.
I try to drive behind them.
Is British Airlines just going to smell really bad? Anyway.
Or good.
Sure. I mean, I don't know if it could smell any worse than
right. Does, so. Very true. Now, I'm assuming if you travel a lot, I spent a year traveling a lot. I don't like being in planes. Are you someone that kind of digs it, or are you kind of?
I don't like the space, but I actually kind of like being on a plane because it's I find myself I'm too connected.
Okay.
And it forces me to disconnect, and so yeah. I can actually do things like sleep or
read a book
yeah. or yeah. you know, just kind of relax and do nothing.
Yeah.
And it's like a perfect space for that. So I'm kind of scared that they're talking about bringing like cell phone reception onto flights and how that might affect my little private space on
right.
the plane.
We'd have to have yeah. like quiet areas and phone areas like exactly. on buses and trains.
It's enforced disconnection.
Yeah.
Which you don't get anywhere other than like airplanes and cruise liners,
it's true.
I guess.
I don't mind that. Yeah, I don't mind being disconnected on flights. That was never my I think I kind of enjoy it as well.
Yeah. I see that as a benefit.
Yeah, absolutely. Like absolutely. Yeah.
I love it too, unless you're flying to India and it takes you 26 hours.
And then that's, there's nothing you can do, which is horrible.
That's
so Ben. Oh, your poor problems, Ben.
I also can't sleep on planes very well either, so.
All right. So, you got any...
It's a first world problem, definitely.
Do you have any aircraft-related news stories?
Why? I do happen to.
All right.
So, Boeing has been working long and hard on a cabin design for a commercial space liner. And they finally have unveiled their plans. That was just about a week and a half ago. They unveiled some pictures and a new concept for the way that they're designing the cabin for this space liner. So basically, if you want to go into space, now I use the word space in air quotes, it's actually low Earth orbit, right? If you want to go into low Earth orbit and experience weightlessness in microgravity, you soon will be able to.
Wait, you soon projects. Will be able to because Boeing has internal design
because
they actually have a program where they're going to be doing this?
Well, there are a number of programs that are...
To me, this story about Boeing building inside is just going, oh, yeah, we're doing stuff too.
Right. Yeah, right.
All the thunder is not them.
Well, they actually didn't release a lot of pictures, but the pictures that they released, I liked. So it kind of looks like... Is it JetBlue? No, Virgin Airways planes that have kind of the when you go in, it's almost like you're in a little nightclub, and it's got the pink glow around the outside.
Yeah,
that's what these pictures.
Yeah,
that's what these pictures look like to me. It's kind of like a weird Star Trek Voyager set mixed with a Virgin Air cabin design mixed with blue instead of there's no pink. It's just and then an interior of a car. It's just kind of a weird design, but it's also a completely different kind of thing, right? So it makes sense.
Speaking of design and future ideas, I was at the Tech Museum in Mountain View last night at a Google Glass Explorers meeting.
Is that in Mountain View or in San Jose?
No, Mountain View. So there's the Tech Museum in San Jose. There's a Tech Museum in Mountain View. I think they're both called the Tech Museum.
Are they both awesome?
Yes.
I've been meaning to go to the San Jose one.
Go to the San Jose one. It's great.
There's a really good Star Wars exhibit at the San Jose
yes.
one. So definitely
what? Really?
You didn't see that, Ben? I think it'd be gone. That was fantastic, wasn't it?
That was really cool.
If it were Star Trek, I'd be
even
more interested.
If you were Star Trek, you would have told us.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, I went to that with the family, and it was amazing. Boba Fett's full costume is there. The land speeder's there. I mean, it was great. If you haven't seen it and still in town, and you live in San Jose area, it's like dwindling possibilities, do take a look at that.
Well, hey, our Santa Cruz listeners could drive over the hill.
So while I'm talking about this, somebody should look up to see if it's called the Tech Museum in Mountain View. But in any case, I was there last night, and they have the Google self-driving car and a whole display about the self-driving car, right? It may say Tech Museum or something. In any case, they had pictures of the 1950s and 1960s advertisements from Chevy and such about self-driving cars, right? So... And they looked beautiful. They didn't work. There was no technology at that point that could do it. But it looked fantastic. So just that Boeing has drawings of space flight, I've seen a lot of good space flight drawings.
Well, I mean, they have to have someone build these interiors, you know? Like,
right.
There are all the different parts of it. I tend to focus a lot more on the rockets and that technology.
But, yeah, definitely.
But it's all important.
All right, did anybody find out if it's called the Tech Museum or not?
So the one in San Jose is called the one in Mountain View is called the Computer History Museum.
There you go. Thank
and
you.
And the one in San Jose is called the Tech Museum of Innovation. So
okay.
They're totally different.
Totally,
not
totally
related
different.
At all.
Right, because yeah. Computers are not technology.
Computers are part of technology. They're not just technology.
So pencils are technology.
The Computer History Museum, I recommend if you're really interested in computer history, because there's a Cray there. There's a whole bunch of tech that you can look at on early computers. Now, it also, I think, I mean, this kind of early computing – also, there's a major piece of this at the Tech Museum as well. So thank you, Shard, for looking into that.
I want to ask you a question about your story, because your story is about computer history. Website history.
Which story is this?
The Wayback Machine.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Yeah.
Nice. So the Wayback Machine, if you're not aware of this, is a project that was started in 1996. And what it does is it's a web crawler that copies websites. So it's a little application, large application at this point, that copies websites' content and stores it. And the idea being that we have this massive collection of our human knowledge, and everybody's responsible for their own little piece, and stuff goes up and comes back down over the era. And there's no hit record of it. There's no way to collect it, except that, of course, for a while, it's completely public and open to everybody. So the Wayback Machine in 1996 started scrawling the websites and saving them. And so now what you can do is you can go look at a website and go look at, you know, Google and at the Wayback Machine and see when they first came online and what it looked like. And pretty much any website you can think of, unless the website decided not to be registered, has been saved over time. Well, what happened just recently was they passed the 400th billionth indexed web page. 400 billion pages.
400 billion?
That's a lot of pages.
Oh my God. I just did that.
Yeah.
That's...
So, if you want to spend too much time looking at old websites, it's always nice to do a selfie, of course, by looking at yourself online and finding out when you went online. I went online in 1996, actually, when it started. That was my first web page.
I wish I remembered.
You weren't born in 1996,
right? Come on. Yeah, I know. I was. I wish I remembered my first web page. I have it. It's on like a zip drive somewhere.
Yeah, well, you should put it online. So
but, like, how likely am I to access a zip drive these days?
So the Wayback Machine is part of the Internet Archive. We'll link to it on the show. What was your first web page, Ben?
I don't remember.
Oh.
That's my problem.
All right. 410 billion web pages saved over time.
One of my earliest websites was for a chocolate maker.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she made custom chocolates. It was awesome.
Sounds delicious.
And I got this 10-pound bar of chocolate from her. It was so good.
More about what Ben likes in chocolate a moment here on Geek Speak. You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell, and the air with me is Ben Jaffe and Shard Mandelik from Adobe. So I decided to take the Wayback Machine at archive.org and look at adobe.com to see when they went online first and all that. So the first Adobe website got archived on October 22nd, 1996. And Shard, this is what it looked like, Adobe looked like in 1996.
Oh my gosh.
It's great, isn't it?
Wow, that's...
What do you think?
It looks nice and clean. There's no pop-ups.
I know. There's no ads.
Yeah, there's nothing flashing at you.
It's a white background, though, not a dark background. Adobe right now is a dark background.
Yeah,
anyway,
dark background.
Let's talk about Lightroom. You're the product manager for Lightroom and actually Camera Raw. And Camera Raw is the big engine behind Lightroom in a lot of ways. And Camera Raw is a non-destructive way of looking at images. So as you modify images, coloring, all these different things you can do to images, black and white stuff, it's not actually modifying the file. It actually produces kind of a sidecar information file, a meta file is what we call it.
Yeah, that's right. And so the general problem that we wanted to solve was we wanted to give people the freedom and the flexibility to edit their images. And we saw that when you did destructive editing, you actually lost a lot of quality.
Yeah.
And your files become pixelated. They look bad.
For years on GeekSpeak, we'd say, well, don't, you know, if you're going to edit the JPEG file, make sure to save it again as a different file. And it actually became this nightmare when you're actually working on files because you make multiple copies and then they don't look like the same file at all, but they are in a lot of ways. So Camera Raw kind of solved that problem.
Exactly. So we, all the changes, it's all metadata. And so, you know, one, you don't have copies of copies of copies of copies. It's just one file, and it's just lines of text.
And Camera Raw comes with, like, Adobe Suite stuff. It, of course, comes with Lightroom. Is it a free product by itself, or is it something that's paid if you have to buy a product to get it?
It's not available by itself.
Okay.
We have a product that is free, which is called the DNG Converter, so it can take your RAW file from your Canon or your Nikon and convert it to a DNG.
A DNG is Adobe's file format, but open standard.
It's an open standard that we've built.
You know, I use Nikon, and so I stay in the Nikon file format. I, for a while, was playing with the idea of converting all my files, but I kind of like the idea of saving the original, and it freaks me out, even though I know the original is actually still there inside the DNG. I can never transfer it over. Is there any benefit to really switching from, like, the Nikon's Camera Raw to Adobe's DNG file format? Is there any benefit in the long run?
I think the biggest benefit is, well, one, since it is an open format, you know that there's always going to be software that can open it.
Okay.
So we saw this with printers. You know, a bunch of companies, when they switched from Windows XP to Windows 7, they never updated older drivers.
Right.
And so if you had this, you know, $15,000, $20,000 commercial printer, and you wanted to print on a new operating system, you had to go and buy another $20,000 printer.
Right.
And so that's a big pain. So with DNG, we know that it's always going to be supported because it's an open, it's an openly documented
right.
format.
But when you think that at this point, because so many people are shooting with these cameras like Nikon and Canon, their file formats also will be long-lived? I mean, I'm curious. I guess we'll find out. I mean, it's possible that Nikon could go away, right? And if Nikon goes away, the software will stop being developed and the converter will be useful.
There's always change in the industry,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so that's,
it's the one thing that stays the same about technology
exactly.
is it changes.
The other thing is with a Nikon file, there's always a sidecar file next to it, which is where we save the metadata changes.
Yeah.
With a DNG, it's all contained in one file. So rather than having to keep track of two files, you only have to keep track of one. So it's a little tidier on your hard drive.
The one thing I've noticed, though, about a sidecar file with NEF files, with NEF files, the Nikon file format, is that because the Nikon file format actually never gets edited at all, the diff on the file, the computer diff on the file, is the same. As you change metadata in a DNG, the diff on the file is separate. So it changes. So that, to me, the backup solution would have a problem because normal backup solutions are going to do a diff to determine if they need a new copy of the file or not. And if you have a sidecar file, all it's copying is the sidecar. So I think when I was playing with DNG, I was forcing the sidecar file to be an external file for that purpose.
Yeah, backup.
Which you can, of course, do. Sure. But you're right. From a simplicity standpoint, it's much better to have all the metadata inside the file. All right. So that's the... A bit. We have shows and shows in the history of GeekSpeak about photography and digital photography and digital asset management because it's one of my passions and I normally decide who comes on the show. So, if you're interested in that kind of topic, please feel free to look in our history of GeekSpeak programs to learn more about those topics. But let's talk about Lightroom Mobile, which is the newest offering and the reason why you're on the show because I just downloaded and started playing with Lightroom Mobile. Lightroom, can you describe what Lightroom is real quick?
Sure. Yeah. So Lightroom... it's an all-in-one application. It lives on your Mac or on your PC, and the general idea is we want to make it as quick and as fast as possible to get files off your card, organized, edited, and then, shared, whether that's out to your friends, to your clients, to your printer. It's all in one program.
Yeah.
And so it's all reading the same raw file, and, you're never converting your file because you don't need to.
Right.
And
so Lightroom, for people that are on Macintosh environment, it's very much like iPhoto in a lot of the ways that you think of what its task is. Like I don't use iPhoto because I use Lightroom. So that's a good way to think
about it. Yeah. I would look at it as iPhoto as kind of like an entry point into digital photography. And then when you want, better processing, better organization, better search, you pick up something like Lightroom.
Right. And then Apple's counter to Lightroom, probably the biggest competitor, is Aperture. I don't know if there's any other big competitors. I think people are using either Aperture or Lightroom if they're a professional photographer. There must be some. Are there other products out there that are like pro-level management software?
Google has something, but I wouldn't call it
pro-level. Google had Picasso and I think they still do. The Google's product stuff is so strange because they have a product like that and then they have an online store for that and then all of a sudden it's integrated into Google Plus but not well. So now your photos are like in Google Plus but they're also in Picasso and you can still kind of use them. It's an uncomfortable space.
Yeah, I used Picasa a couple of years ago. I was unimpressed. I can't say what it's like now, but I don't get the impression that it's a serious contender.
Yeah. Well, in any case, so Lightroom does this management thing. The way my workflow takes, I take a lot of photos on different devices, an iPhone, a Nexus device, Nexus 5, a Google Glass, and of course my Nikon SLR. And whenever I'm filled up or want to continue, I take all that and I suck it into Lightroom. And one of the patterns I do is I pull all those files and I rename them by the date that they're used with the index of the original file. So I've got unique names for every single photo as soon as it comes to my computer. And then Lightroom allows me to make changes to cropping or color or delete photos, of course, and all those things. It becomes my library for my photography. And I think I've got two catalogs right now pushing 200,000 photos. So,
oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's a lot. And I kind of want to put it back into one catalog. I've been debating on whether I want to merge it back in. I kind of think I did a split in 2013. All the photos after that was too far.
Sure.
So the reason it's useful, even for an insane person like me that takes too many photos, it becomes kind of paramount because there's no way for me to find. If I had just files inside a folder, it would be a lot of crawling around to try to find something. And, of course, Lightroom's got the whole ability to take the photo, the full-size photo, make a smaller image of it that it can then navigate quickly through. So you can scan through those hundreds of thousands of photos really fast and find the ones you want. That's kind of why I use it and love it.
Sure.
Yeah. So mobile, though, so I And let me just describe another salute problem, of course, is you want to share photos with people, and we have way too many choices to do that, right? Like, you can go through Facebook, you can go through Google Plus, you can go through some sharing website for photos, and all of these have their drawbacks and benefits. And the other benefit of Lightroom is that it's has a plug-in architecture, so you can actually hook into those devices, into those other services, and push photos that direction. So,
exactly. And so we, again, going back to the idea of you edit it once and it's available everywhere, that's kind of what Lightroom, one of the core principles behind Lightroom.
Yeah.
And so we don't want you to have to worry about managing files on your disk or, oh, did I send that to Facebook, did I send that to Twitter, where did I push it to?
Right.
It's all just, if you do it inside of Lightroom, we manage everything, we take care of everything for you,
right.
So you don't have to worry about that.
So if I take a photo and I push it to Facebook from Lightroom, and then I edit the photo later or add keywords or something, is it able to take that data and push it back to Facebook, or does Facebook not actually support that? I mean,
it really depends on the different service. So Facebook, they don't actually have that find and replace type functionality.
Right.
So what it can do is it can actually replace it, but then it squashes all your original
comments,
and all that. So Facebook, what we end up doing is we end up just creating a second copy so that you don't lose that original information.
Right. And does it pull information from comments and stuff back in?
Yep.
Or
mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so the comments and the likes do come back into your catalog so you can take a look at them.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty neat.
Yeah, I mean, it feels to me like we're at the precipice of doing this. Like right now, we see this explosion of social media where there's all these different places for people to play, Pinterest and all these different services, and they get a whole community around that environment. But all that stuff is actually owned by that environment. So when Pinterest goes away, not that it will, but you know, any of these services go away, or your account gets deleted or taken over, all of a sudden that whole social interaction you had is now lost and away from you and not controlled by you. So I like the idea of any service or system that allows to pull that data back in so you have ownership about it. I like that.
And that's a feeling of integration as well, because at least my experience with many of the social networking sites and the content sites is I have to go to those sites in order to experience the content there.
Yeah.
And there have been a lot of attempts to bring that content into your own applications. There are mail clients that center around social. There are
but
all
the
kinds
truth
of
is
things,
the service but, doesn't want you to do that.
Yeah, they
right?
they don't, because they want you to go and view their pages, and then they can serve you ads.
So let's talk a bit about the mobile product.
Sure.
This is an iOS only app, right? You're not doing Android yet, right?
Not yet.
Yeah.
No. So we've got iPad is out right now, and so it was released about a month ago. And the exciting thing about it is what we saw is that a lot of photographers have this really disjointed workflow. So, you know, on the team, we always think about workflows. And what they were doing is they were taking their RAW files, they were, you know, exporting JPEGs through iTunes to put them on their iPad so they could show them to friends.
Yeah.
But then you
Then
you couldn't actually edit the files. Anything that you did with the photo on your iPad is just kind of stuck on your iPad.
Mm-hmm.
And so so we built a product that we call Lightroom Mobile, and it works using proxies or smart previews, and we take your RAW file, so somewhere from each RAW file is around 30 megabytes, give or take. And
depending on the camera.
Yeah, depending on the camera, the resolution.
Mm-hmm.
The smart preview is somewhere between 1 and 2 megabytes.
Right,
so it's
a lot smaller.
Tons smaller, but you have the same editing controls because it's based on that same RAW format.
Right. So what you're saying is the smart preview is kind of a smaller version of the RAW file format. So as you make all these changes that are non-destructive, you can see it, you can play with it. And then if you actually wanted to do like a large print and needed all the pixels back, you plug in your external drive that actually has the original file, and all those changes get synced over.
Automatically.
And that's been working in Lightroom for a while, actually, since version 5, I think.
Yeah, so we introduced that in Lightroom 5 with kind of the idea that we knew that this would be cool on the desktop.
Yeah.
But it becomes even more powerful because you look at iPads or iPhones or Android devices, and there's not as much processing power, and you don't have as much hard drive space on these devices. And so a smart preview is optimized for mobile.
Yeah.
And so with Lightroom Mobile, we use the smart preview. You make some changes, you make some edits, the same tools that you have in Lightroom Desktop. Those are automatically synced back to your original, back on your desktop through cloud services.
Yeah.
And so now, you know, you edit once and you're...
It's interesting. All the discussion about the product from a marketing perspective is exactly that it's on your device, you can then edit. And I'm thinking, you know, I don't mind editing on my computer. I have more, you know, I'm pretty fluent in Lightroom now, learning any more tools. Yeah. So what I tried it out, of course, because you were coming on the show and you said, try it out. And I was like, that's a good idea. So I went ahead, and what you do is you take collections of photographs and then you can say, sync these. And you have to make an Adobe account. And it syncs to the Adobe account, and then when you get your mobile device, you connect that up too, and it pulls all those images down. Then it also takes images from your device and pushes them back in Lightroom, which is awesome.
Yep.
Because then, yeah, not that I take a lot of photographs with my tablet, but it is nice to know that they're saved. Of course, they're there. So in any case, I was just the collection I used was all the photographs in my collection from 2000. I think all of them that are starred, and I don't star a lot of photos. I only star the ones that are really, I think, awesome or I'm using. And so all of a sudden I had all these photos and I'm sitting on the couch with my kids and we're flipping through photos like a photo book and it's in my hand and it's photos that I've seen, of course, 100 times, but the kids have not seen necessarily. And it was a great experience just having access to them on an iPad. Mm-hmm. That was like, and so the first night, all we did was look at photos. I didn't do any editing or anything.
Sure.
And then the editing thing came in place when I realized I hadn't cropped something. I was like, oh, I should crop this. All right. And it will sync. And then I won't have to do it again. Like, it was magic. It was the aha point. It was the winning moment, definitely.
Yeah. So, I mean, editing, we talk a lot about editing, and I think editing is really important. But actually, you know, the experience on Lightroom Mobile is distinctly different than on desktop.
Yeah.
And it's really optimized for browsing and viewing because I think, you know, the screens are so crisp and the form factor is great for viewing.
Yeah.
So we've heard from a lot of our customers that that's exactly what they like to do. They're like, it's nice that we can edit, but it's really fun to go back and look at old photos that we might not have looked at.
Yeah.
Because they're just stuck in our catalog somewhere.
And, you know, for professional photographers, what a boon, right? Because you can take the iPad back with the client and say, what do you like? It's one of the features that actually, I'm going to go ahead and do a couple feature requests for you. I like that you've got pick and reject, though the interface for it keeps on accidentally choosing it. I keep on accidentally choosing pick and reject because you can swipe up and down. So that's a little frustrating. As I'm an iOS developer, right? That's what I do is develop iOS apps. So right now, at least. So I'm sensitive to that. The other thing what I notice is I use keywords a lot. And your next revision, if it had a way to keyword stuff, I would be in heaven. And keyword, basically, you take a phrase, you know, take a keyword. I use it for names mostly of places and people. And I just have a giant arc of everybody I ever have met that I've taken a photograph of. I add them to my system. Anytime I take a photograph of them, I tag their name to that photo. So I can go to Ben and say, Ben, I've got, you know,
that's happened before.
2,000 photos of you.
Yeah.
Here you go.
Hey, Lyle, I'm looking for a new professional photograph. Do you have any of me?
Yeah, it's and really just, easy for me to do that. Yeah.
Just like that, he has them.
Because of Lightroom's keywording capabilities. So the thing that I don't like doing, of course, is being on the computer when at the end of the day. So having it on the device, that'd be great. The
sure,
next feature.
That makes total sense. Yeah.
And then I guess, I don't know, are you doing ranking with stars and such? I don't think you are.
So right now we're not.
Yeah.
That's something that's on our roadmap.
And yeah.
So we're probably, you know, in the next probably couple months to a year.
Keywords are going to be a much more complicated feature to add in because
keywords are tough because typing on the device is
right.
Just, it's kind of painful.
Yeah.
And
right.
So we're still kind of grappling with, if we're going to do it, how would we do it?
Yeah, and I would think you wouldn't even do necessarily adding new keywords. You'd only be able to use the ones that are already in your library or something. But then there's the question of what's your library? Because, of course, I'm assuming this mobile device, any libraries I connect to it, I could sync over photos from multiple libraries. But the libraries have their own keyword files. I mean, there's some complexity in there, definitely.
So we've actually kind of solved that by it's actually just one catalog.
Okay, so you choose one catalog
to
sync
over.
That's good.
And then if you want to choose a different catalog, then you choose that one and you don't have access to the first. So it is a single catalog.
We're speaking with Shard Mangalik. He's the Mangalik?
Mangalik.
Yeah. Mangalik, yeah. Sorry. Shard Mangalik from Adobe. We're talking about Lightroom and Lightroom Mobile, which is a new iOS product from Adobe that allows you to kind of sync up your photos from your Lightroom catalog to your mobile device. And also in the room with me is Ben Jaffe. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Geek Speak. We're talking about digital photography and things that are visual because that's awesome for radio. So, Ben, do you have more awesome radio content?
I do. I have a couple geek bits. Of course, geek bits are things that you probably should rather see rather than just listen to us talk about it. The first is actually a strange geek bit. Instead of being a visual geek bit, it is an olfactoral geek bit.
Well, we could play that.
It is called, olfactoral as in smell.
Oh, how you see that online?
I don't know.
What is it?
Bit cologne. That's a Bitcoin-themed cologne.
That's probably like the most meta thing I've ever heard.
That is
like, it we're going to take a virtual currency and we're going to make a smell associated with it.
Exactly. And then, exactly.
Yeah.
It's like,
okay.
So I just want to read a couple. Now, this is totally a publicity stunt, right?
Good.
Totally a publicity
stunt. Keep in mind, Ben invests in Bitcoin, so you can't trust anything he said.
I do not. Okay. I also don't use cologne, so I'm really not a great person.
You're actually
about
the best person to talk about this story.
Yes,
maybe.
You know cologne and
maybe. So I'm not saying go out and buy this, but it is BitCologne, the first cryptocurrency-themed cologne, quote, made for peer-to-peer interaction. And then the other quote is, it's an aromatic blend of spicy, floral, oak, and citrus notes your partner may find hard to resist initiating a more private transaction. So a couple silly, you know, geeky jokes in there. I got one more geek bit, which is you can finally now watch a live video feed of Earth from space. And it's awesome. That is verbatim the
that's
headline
the news
of
story.
This.
Live video feed from space.
The International Space Station is now streaming the Earth spinning. Or rather,
I'm really partial to that product, that planet, so that's good.
Yeah, I like that. Earth is, yeah. I think, well, I don't know.
It's my favorite planet.
Is it my favorite planet? Yeah. I like Venus.
Yeah. Why don't you go live there?
It's the greenhouse effect, right?
Hey, let's go ahead and take a call on GeekSpeak. That's always a fun thing to do. As I notice the buttons are not lighting up. We might take a call in a moment. So, Shard, one of the things I mentioned is that I've got multiple catalogs, and the reason I did that in Lightroom is because I felt like 150,000 photos might be a lot. And so I split into two catalogs, which is actually kind of a pain because I'm looking for a photo. So is it safe for me to take that, squish it together, and how big can a catalog get and still work?
I think it's always a good idea to have a single catalog. So some of the benefits are really you can search across all your images in one place. You don't have to like open different files.
That's the benefit right there.
That's the main benefit.
Keywords being the same across, like if you make a new keyword on one catalog but you don't make the same one the other one, it's
everything's all kept in.
So you have one place to go to for all of your photos instead of two places to go to.
Which for years I did that, and then I think I changed jobs and had a different computer and thought, well, this would be a good time to make a new one because I was always thinking that maybe it's getting too slow. But that might not be a problem.
No, yeah. And so back in the early days of Lightroom, that actually was a real problem. And between, I think, Lightroom 3 and Lightroom 4, maybe between 2 and 3, we made a bunch of improvements. And so now, you know, we've gotten anecdotal evidence that there's catalogs as large as 20 million images.
Oh, 20 million?
So I think, 20 you know, million?
Yeah, I think 200,000.
200,000 can be fine.
That's 100. Be okay. That's 100 of your catalogs.
All right. I'll make sure to duplicate all my files to DNG, disassociate them, and then I'll double my size. No. Okay, good. Good to know. Okay. Now, of course, it's interesting doing a radio program where it's a volunteer and it's you know, we're commercial-free radio, which means that we can't legally, from the FCC license, we can't promote a product. So when we do a show, and clearly I love Lightroom so much, and you're from Adobe, and it seems like there could definitely be conflict of interest. So I just want to stress or urge everybody to understand that it's my personal feelings about Lightroom that I like. I'm not saying to go buy it for in any technology and geek speak. When people say, well, should I get a Mac or a PC? I talk about who they are and what they want and what their experience is. And the answer is always personal. So just because we talk about we like it, if you want to be just like us, yeah, you could do that. But don't, you know, think as a consumer. And we're not endorsing it, and we're not talking about price on the program. I personally like the product. So that's is that good enough?
I use Aperture.
You use Aperture?
No, I don't.
Oh, darn. I wish you had, Ben.
Actually, I use iPhoto.
Yeah.
Just because.
It's so easy.
Yeah, I don't know. I just don't. And I don't take photos.
And you're not a serious photographer.
Yeah, that's true. I sold my nice camera, and now I use my phone, and that's about it.
All right, from Boulder Creek, Paul, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Wow, hello, I'm here.
I believe you, I can hear you.
Oh, God, love my old Samsung Galaxy. Anyway, so the reason I called is because I have this MacBook Pro, and it really works for me. Daughter gave it back after she finished college and got a job. So I got to upgrade. Okay, so I use Graphic Converter by Lemkesoft.
Sure, Graphic Converter is kind of a famous converting tool.
Okay, so, you know, in my limited needs graphically, but talking about, I'm an amateur photographer, so I just take 100 pictures to get 5, you know. How
yeah,
those.
Awesome.
And I'm just saying that this has been a robust program for me. I've been listening to you guys, and this whole Lightroom thing is just hooking me. I'm just wondering what the heck. But not being a geek, being a geezer, a retired geezer, I'm just saying nobody said anything about Graphic Converter. I don't particularly like iPhoto on my Mac. So anyway, but what do you think about Graphic Converter?
Yeah, no, Graphic Converter. I mean, Graphic Converter is the one I'm thinking of that's been around since before Photoshop existed, possibly. Do you remember the product that was, Shar, do you remember the product that was called, I think it's called Graphic Converter. It was like, command line utility, but it
1992.
Wasn't.
1992.
Yeah, it's been a long time. And this thing.
Oh, yeah, And they give it to you, and they remind you that you've been using it for 3,521 days, and would you like to buy now?
Yeah.
Would you like to buy a copy?
Yeah, Graphic Converter, when I was a web developer before the web existed, like right in that space, Graphic Converter is the thing you use to make GIFs, make animated GIFs. Like, that's how you did it, or GIFs, depending on who you are. And Graphic Converter, I'm surprised they're still around. I think it's fantastic. I think that in the web development space now, Adobe's kind of just one. They're everywhere. So I don't think people a lot use this. There's also command line tools that have most of these features. But it looks like Graphic Converter's, you know, pretty functional application. Yeah, Graphic Converter, iPhoto. Graphic Converter is not a photo management tool, and Lightroom is a photo management tool. So this is really when you have a catalog. That's kind of my thoughts. Do you know that Graphic Converter, Shard?
You know, I've never played with Graphic Converter. I think... So the first thing is, if it's working for you, then
you're good.
Then you're probably good. But if you're running into challenges, then you know maybe that's something like Lightroom or some other program might be able to solve. But if it's working for you, then I would say
stay where you are. Yeah. Definitely.
And I'll leave you with it. You know, just going happily into retirement, Mike. What a sweet thing, the American dream. And so. Now I get to follow certain passions, and my daughter and her husband there, and I said, "Give me a tutorial for Christ's sake."
Yeah.
But timing is everything. So I'm just saying that I'm really happy to have tuned in today, and this whole Lightroom deal, and all the stuff that's out there. But I just wanted a heads up to lump this off and the Graphic Converter. I'm not selling it, but. It works
all right.
For me. And that's the thing.
Thank you, Paul, for the...
And that's why I listen to you guys.
Sure. Well, okay. Thank you so much, Paul, for the call. Thank you.
So one of the things that we can probably do is, I should ask if we can do, is in the show notes, I can send you some content around how to get started with Lightroom, things like that. That might be useful.
Yeah, if people are going to go over, it's definitely a big, there's a bit of a barrier to using a more robust, a more professional application, I should say. And we're talking about photos. I can't not mention Smug Mug, which is an amazing service for photo management. That's what I use, and it's paid. I spend a lot of money on it, actually, every year. And it's doing some of the things that now Adobe's supporting with the cloud product. So, Shard, can you tell me a little bit about, like, right now the way this product works is I'm sending my photos off to Adobe, and Adobe puts them in a system that then the device can sync to. It's not like it's being synced through my local Wi-Fi. I have to have an account through Adobe. Why do you guys go that way rather than doing something more without you having this big infrastructure in place to do it?
So the biggest thing was we wanted to make it so that when you made a change anywhere, even when you weren't at home, it found its way back home to your desktop catalog. Mm-hmm. And so with other solutions and other tools that rely on your local network, we found that there's a lot of challenges with things syncing, with things not working, with things just... There was a lot of frustration associated with that. And so the easiest way for us to solve that was actually just to create a central database that everything syncs to, and that can reconcile everything. And
it was
to solve a technical problem, but really the end pain point was that we wanted to make it so that when someone edited or looked at something or flagged something at a cafe in Paris, their computer back in San Francisco...
assuming it's online.
Right. Assuming everything's online.
But basically the idea that as soon as you've edited and it's got network, the truth of the system is up at the Adobe Cloud service.
Exactly.
And then anytime they need devices, connect to it. So does that mean you can use multiple devices of the same account?
That's right.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it feels like we should go ahead and take other calls with questions and comments about technology around digital management, photo management, editing, things of that nature. You got an old catalog of photos that you're dealing with or... In that space, please feel free to give us a call. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. We can definitely take your calls about photography and digital management and all that stuff. Now, Lightroom also supports now video, and I'm just curious. I don't shoot video like crazy, but now that all of my devices shoot video, I end up having a lot of video. Are you thinking about a secondary product? It seems to me that there's a larger problem with video because their file size is so massive. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, we don't necessarily one of the benefits of being at Adobe is we have a ton of technologies around video. We've got, you know, Premiere Elements. Sure. We've got Premiere Pro. We have After Effects. We have SpeedGrade. I mean, there's like a whole suite of products just around video. So with us, it was when we looked at video, it was really around the fact that every camera in the world now takes video. And it was not so that you can make the next, you know, Academy Award-winning film inside a Lightroom, although that would be really cool. It was more around the fact that people have just videos that we know that they never look at and right. they never do anything to. And so it was just a way for them to use the same tools that they're using inside a Lightroom to just manage and edit their videos.
Yeah.
It was never to replace a full-functioned, non-linear video
yeah.
editor.
Yeah, interesting. So. All right, from Salinas, Bob, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yeah, hi. Is there a photo application that you could scan photos from magazines and
get rid of that gradient
that would clear up the dots?
Yeah, right. Good question. So when you print in traditional print content like a magazine or newspaper, you actually have a whole elliptical shaped dots, and that has to do with the printing process. And so the visual, you know, it's not a big deal when you're looking at the size. They make it designed so it works well for your eye. But of course, when you scan that and want to do other things with it, there's a lot of problems there. What is that called, Chard? Do you know what
Moiré
that
Moiré effect?
Moiré. Well, yeah, it's definitely Moiré effects merge from those dots. Yeah. Is there a way to get rid of that in Lightroom? It's a Photoshop thing.
You know, I'd have to check and see. I know that there is a way to do it. Let me...
We will get... So now I'm assuming your colleagues will know this, right? Somebody at Adobe will know exactly how to do this.
What I can do is, I can make some calls when I get back home and get an answer and get it online.
I've done this problem before, Bob. I've scanned something that had dots in it, like an old press shot of my family or whatever, and got rid of them. And it's like went through three filters in Photoshop. And of course, it's a bit of artistry because the data's not there and you're trying to blur it and sharpen it without losing content, and it's a tricky thing to do. I don't know if there's like a one button push kind of thing, but what we'll do, Chard and I are both into this kind of topic, so we'll look into this. Sure. And I have colleagues that will help us out.
Yeah, one of my colleagues, a product manager on the Photoshop team, Brian O'Neill Hughes, who we've had on the show.
Yeah.
So he actually has a video, not specifically around this, but around recovering old photos. So if you scan in an old photo, kind of what are some of the steps that you can do to recover either lost details or cracked edges or things like that?
It's interesting because this point, this question, it might not be something that a large corporation wants to say, this is how you do it, because it's kind of inferred that if you've got a magazine print only or a newspaper print only, you might not have rights to that photo. And so there's that whole copyright potential issue. But definitely we should be able to solve the technical problems.
There are tools that you can use to do that inside of Photoshop. And,
cool.
Okay, Photoshop. Right. Then, huh?
Well, what we'll do is we'll figure it out. We'll assign it to today's show so you can see a bit about it. Thanks, Bob, for the call.
Okay.
All right.
GeekSpeak.org.
Yeah, of course, the trouble with that one is it's not pixelization that we're actually talking about. It's actually this other feature, which I used to know when I was doing traditional printing press, but I don't do that kind of thing anymore. All right, and also from, let's see, Santa Cruz, Dan, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, thank you. I think that what you were talking about earlier, there's the screen angles that need to be 15 degrees apart, and if they're not, then you get a Moiré pattern. But there's a plug-in in Photoshop that's called Median, and I think if you slightly use it, it will blur it to the point where you don't have that distortion.
Nice.
Yeah. It's always a fine line how to blur it just right but not end up with a blurry image.
Yeah. So what's your question, Dan?
Yeah, it's from I use Aputure in iTunes, and I like how it integrates with the iPhone and the Apple devices for albums and sorting.
Yeah, exactly.
Is Lightroom ever going to support or be able to use their albums within iTunes?
So what we're talking about is when you're in Apple and you use your photos in iPhoto, you can actually take one of those catalogs in iPhoto and say, iTunes, sync this to your device, which solves this whole problem, right? And it is a great feature. Why isn't Lightroom doing that?
So one of the things, we've asked to actually be able to do that. It's one of the challenges with Apple. One of the benefits is actually, you know, the fact that all of their products work seamlessly together.
Yeah, the integration, sure.
Which the integration. One of the challenges around that same problem, though, is that they don't allow third-party developers as much access as we'd like. And
right.
So, you know, that's one of the requests that we've had in the past. And once we get access, you know, it'd be something that we can do, but we just don't have access.
And the end point of that whole thing is to get your photos, of course, easily onto a mobile device. And there you go, Lightroom Mobile. That's what you kind of suggest.
It's kind of like, you know, another way of doing it if you're using Lightroom.
Dan, does that unsatisfactorily answer your question?
Well, yeah, I had a feeling that that was going to be the answer, but yeah. I'll wait.
You know, and as a developer, I understand that tight integration development, it's harder to allow that to be an open community because you take shortcuts to make that work really well. The reason it integrates so well is because they make really specific rules. And if they open up an API for that for other developers, it's going to be harder for them to do that. And, of course, the benefit of buying a Mac is that whole circle, that whole loop.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's a little too closed-minded for me.
Yeah, Apple's not been known for their open-mindedness. Thank you, Dan, for the call on GeekSpeak.
Sure.
I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Well, Shard, thank you so much. Was there anything we touched on that you want to make sure we had clarity on?
I think
doing is taking notes on things you're going to help with after the fact.
I
right?
am.
Yeah,
I
awesome.
Am. I'm using one of these great donor cards, which is probably not why you guys designed these donor cards here, but I do have a reminder.
good. And I want to reiterate, you've got to get keywords in this application, please. One other question I've got for you is, are you going to produce an API of any sort for us as developers to interact with your cloud system so that we can do our own tools that integrate with those photos?
So we don't have one yet. It's okay. One of those things it's on our roadmap. It's something that we're thinking about. But if you guys have feedback or as developers, if there's things that you want,
I got to say what I want is I want to be able to build a keywording tool that can do the same thing.
Sure.
Anyway, thank you, Shard, for being here on GeekSpeak. This is GeekSpeak on 88.9 KUSP. And of course, we're online at geekspeak.org. We'll have photos of all of us after the show that you've been taking. Thank you so much. And we've been talking about Lightroom and the wonderful products over at Adobe. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3 share and share alike. You can do anything you want with our content as long as you tell them the Geek sent you. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP, Santa Cruz. Online at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit geekspeak.org. I'm Lyle Troxell, Ben and Chard with me in the air room. See you next week.